You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand and even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
It's time for another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.
Welcome to another BritFlix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guest is Ian David Diaz. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure, my pleasure. Now, we're here to look back on a film that you made in 1999 called The Killing Zone. You want to tell us why you got in touch about wanting to talk about this on the podcast for the listener?
Essentially, one of my friends who produced the film, Julian Boot, he died recently. He died of a brain tumor. Okay. And
sorry for your loss.
You know, we've always fought to try and get this film noticed, and it really hasn't been noticed, because what we achieved was something very unique for its time. And I think it's about time that people knew about how we made this film. Mm-hmm. A bunch of nobodies, basically working class stiffs that had really no connection to the British film industry, and we made this film. It almost killed us.
Before we get into the details of it, how can people see The Killing Zone?
They can go on my channel, which is the Rebecca Gold channel. Mm-hmm. On YouTube, just type in Rebecca Gold. Rebecca Gold's a web series. Mm-hmm. And the film is on there. It's the director's cut, because when it got released, it wasn't really produced very well, especially on DVD and stuff like that. It just wasn't produced very well. So basically, I took it, and because of the AIs they've got now, I upscaled it and graded it the way it should have been, and put it out there for all to see.
So when you say all to see, so people can just see it for free, or they have to pay to
It's for free. It's for free, yep.
Brilliant. So we'll put a link in the show notes so people can do that at their leisure. Mm-hmm. So to give them an incentive, do you want to give a brief synopsis to what The Killing Zone is all about?
Okay, so The Killing Zone is about an assassin called Matthew Palmer. Mm-hmm. And he has 3 days to retire. And it's basically his journey through 3 stories told within one film, and how basically he gets in trouble by trying to complete those 3 jobs, basically. That's basically what it's about.
Yeah, indeed. The classic, I'll retire after this, and then a load of unbelievable obstacles get in the way that mean that retiring is not as easy as he first thought.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
You wrote and directed this film.
Yes.
So for you, what was the kernel of the idea that got you going on what became The Killing Zone?
Okay, so Julian and myself, we created a production company called the 712 Collective. Mm-hmm. It doesn't exist anymore because of time and money and stuff like that. We were working class people. We desperately wanted to be filmmakers, but it seems like the door was always closed for 1,000 reasons, million reasons.
Yeah.
And we decided to make a short. So we made a short called The Interrogation, which basically is about these two guys that get interrogated by the mob because something went wrong. they're supposed to deliver something and something went wrong. And we made that for £1,000. So we shot that in over a weekend and made it for £1,000. So Julian said to me, it's time we made a feature film. And so the thinking was, let's make this short and make four other shorts and stick them all together. So that would cost us £4,000 and that'd be a feature film, right?
Obviously.
But it's a solid idea, but it in theory, it doesn't work because making a feature film is a different animal to making a short. So basically, we wanted to raise money. So we were trying to find out how we can raise money, how can we let people see who we are and try and find people who could fund the film.
Right.
But it was very difficult because we don't live in that circle. We don't live in a circle of people who have money. You know, we were just people that worked at Tesco's or, you know, Waitrose. You know, that's the kind of people we were.
Right.
So what we decided to do is try and put an advert in a newspaper, but newspapers cost money to put an advert in. And so that idea didn't work. But then we came across a newspaper called Loot. This is 1997 at the time.
Cool.
And I don't know if you remember.
So
we're pre-internet.
So yes, I do know Loot. Yes. Indeed. I found
pre-internet.
Found one of my flats in there when I first moved to London.
So yeah, so we didn't have the internet. This is 1997, I think, and we decided to put an advert in Loot. And so basically, what we put in there was, if you want to be part of a film production and you have no experience whatsoever, call this number. That's what we put in there because it was free. Because Loot was like eBay, I guess, people selling shoes, you know, want to rent out their flat, you know, all that kind of stuff. So we put an advert in there. And one weekend, the phone didn't stop. It just didn't stop. The phone kept ringing and ringing and ringing. And so this is, to cut long story short, this is how we sold it. We said, look, you can either take £1,000 and go on some stupid BBC course and learn nothing, or you can give us £1,000. We can throw you in the deep end and you learn that way. Again, to cut long story short, 14 people said yes. One of them was a lawyer. And we raised £14,000 and we shot at Killing Zone in 2 weeks on Super 16 film.
Lovely.
Yeah, and that's how we did it, basically.
So that's the practicalities of it and the motivation to do it. So when you sat down at your desk to then pencil these three interwoven stories about one man's bloody attempt to retire. Where was the idea for that coming from? Where did you start with that?
Okay, so I'm a huge fan of British movies. Particularly, I love Michael Caine. And I saw a film called The Ypres File, which is one of my favorite movies. I love that film. And at the same time, I'm into comics and movies. And I saw a comic book called Sin City, which Frank Miller had just released. I think it was around about that time. I'm not sure.
Makes sense.
And I fell in love with that. I fell in love with that kind of thing. The film noir. I love the 60s look. I love the suits and stuff like that. So I decided to create a character that was like the character in Ypres File.
Okay.
So the character, yeah. So a character I created was a character called Matthew Palmer. And in the Ypres File, the character's called Harry Palmer.
Indeed. No, I get there's a heavy nod.
You know, the idea of a hitman that's basically neat. He looks neat from head to foot. You know, he makes sure that every job is meticulous, and he, you know, does his job and then just moves on. Was appealing to me, and as I said, the idea of having three stories connected, woven in, also helps with the production because we weren't stupid. We realized we were up against an impossible task. Everybody told us we shouldn't do it. But going back to the story, the idea that I created the three stories so that it will help in production as well. So the idea was Palmer, Matthew, would go through the three stories. He'd be the only actor that would go through the three stories.
Yeah.
Therefore, the other actors that were in the other three stories would only have a total of either 3 days or 2 days shooting, which basically doesn't lock them down for 2 weeks of a shoot. Right. So it just locks them down to the 3 days that we were shooting each story or the 2 days that we were shooting each story. They just locked them down to that. Also, including the crew as well. So the crew, so like you'd have, I'd have a sound man for the first story, have a second sound man for the second story and maybe the third story, you know, so it wouldn't lock them down. So they could contribute for free because everybody was working for free and not spoil their you know, not spoil their schedule of actually making money. So that's how it was arranged. But the idea was,
just let me stop you there for a second. But I think for the first time filmmaker who's on the brink of doing their first film, there's a lot of advice wrapped up in what you described in terms of the practicalities of, you know, knowing full well that you're taking advantage of people who are giving their time for free, but then you're making it as easy for them to be able to do it because of the way you're going to make the film.
But that's the idea, you see, because we, as I said, we weren't stupid. Look, you could have all the money in the world to make a movie, but if you don't have common sense, then it's not going to happen. Right? Common sense is the key. And also, time is always against you as well. It's always time. When you're shooting on set, it's time. Mm. So I know you want to know how I created the story. As I said, the idea was that I was in love with this whole idea of the 60s and Harry Palmer from the Ipcress Files and stuff like that. And I created this almost indestructible assassin stroke hitman.
Yeah.
He was so cool. You know, he's got side parting, he's got glasses, you know. And if you look at the three stories carefully, his involvement's very minimum. He's just there to kill someone and then move on to the next job. So the three stories is about the character around. That's how I approached it. And also, I approached it that it was only one location on each story, which will cut down on money as well. It wasn't bouncing around and stuff like that. You know, and mostly they were in one location. So
in a sense, you were writing for those constraints as much as you were aware of those constraints are going to be important to the success of the production.
Yeah, there's no other way to do it because we had to write to the constraints of the amount of money that we had, the amount of time that we had. So we had to think about those situations.
Mm.
As I said, you know, we didn't just go out there with the camera and just say, like, let's just shoot. We had a shot list, you know, we had and most importantly of all is to have rehearsals. So if you're making a feature film and it's a 2 week shoot or whatever how long it is, when you're on set, time is a killer. Time will destroy what you're trying to do. So one of the ways to deal with that is to rehearse with your cast as much as you can before you set foot on the set. Because with rehearsals, once everybody knows where they're standing, once everybody knows what they're saying, once you set foot on the set, it's merely a formality.
Right.
And I can concentrate on making sure the camera shots is what I want and stuff like that. When an actor comes up to me, which had happened on this film, and said, Ian, I want to talk about motivation, I would say to them, no, I don't want to talk about motivation because we spoke about this before. We spoke about this in rehearsals. I told you everything that was done in rehearsals, we're going to do now. Right. So basically, get to your mark. We're ready to shoot. You know, that kind of thing. So I was really tough on the killing zone because I knew we were up against impossible odds. You know, we only had 2 hours sleep every night.
Bloody hell.
That, I mean, it was a nightmare to shoot. But everyone, my core team, was determined to get this thing done. You know, because we wanted to prove that, you know, not only do, you know, rich middle class or upper class kids have the chance to make movies and we don't. We want to show them that we can make a movie and with very little money that we had as well. We're just as important as they are because I couldn't afford to go to film school. In fact, no one I knew working on the set could afford to go to film school. I think a couple of people went to film school, I think, but they were like...
But what you've just described before is fairly canny because I remember I interviewed Dominic Brunt, who for his second film, Bait, had a similar constraint to you where time was going to kill the film. So again, like yourself, he did some rehearsals, but he also made it clear to anyone coming on the cast that, you know, I'm not interested in talking about different things. We're going to do it this one way, and it's going to be, and that's going to be what we'll achieve making the film. I can't be talking about what the character might do on this scene or that scene. We're going to hit your mark. Mm. We're going to shoot the shot, and then we're going to move on to the next shot, you know, and so on and so yeah. forth. So I think what you hit upon there, you know, using your, and it was great because I guess you had the ammo of, we've done this, we've talked about this already. So any question you're asking me now, your time to ask was when it was for free. This is now not free time because we're in the shoot.
Yeah. Yeah. It is what it is at the end of the day, you know. Mm. I mean, I'll tell you something that actually happened on set. So the second day we were shooting, we were grossly over our time.
Right.
And we were on this one set. We were in a, it was called Hartley's Jam Factory. It was like a big warehouse that we were in. And my first, who was one of the most, he's probably more experienced than most people on set.
Mm-hmm.
She worked for the BBC. She was a first. She worked for the BBC. And we were going over, and she pulled me aside. And she said, "Ian, we've got to stop." And I said, "Why?" And she said, "Because the crew and the cast are tired, and we can't just keep going because we need to stop." And I said, "Well, we need to shoot all this stuff before we leave this location. I can't afford to come back." And you said, "No, you've got to. Look, let's shoot everything tomorrow, and then after everything's shot, we can come back." And I said to her, "Do you have the money so I can come back?" And she said, "No." And I said, "Well, I'm going to carry on shooting." And she got so upset that she walked off. And then I promoted my third as the first. But the point I'm trying to make here is that when you're in that situation, you can't apply the rules of a big budget film to something like this. Right, we all knew what we signed up for, and if you want to bail out now, so for instance, when she walked off, I basically went on set, and it was like about, I think it was like 85 people strong. I went and I stood on an apple box and I said, "Look, we're going to go to 2 o'clock in the morning." I said to them, "Look, if anybody wants to bail now, please go now. No, but we have to complete this," and none of them left. And so my grip, Frank, wonderful guy named Frank Halliburton, he got his credit card out and he brought all these beers, and he got all these beers in and wine and stuff, and everybody started drinking. So at 2 o'clock in the morning, most people were drunk, but we got the shots done.
Brilliant.
So do you know what I mean? And that's just one of the examples of being determined to shoot this. Because I just off the side of it, I remember listening to Spielberg talk about Duel, when he shot Duel, and he had 12 days to shoot Duel.
Mm.
And he was like 21, 22, whatever, I can't remember, 25. And he used one stretch of road to shoot all that stuff. So he had like loads of cameras set up, whatever. And then somebody asked him, "Look, you know, that was amazing what you did when you were that." And Spielberg said, "You know what, right?" And he said, "I could not do that now. I could not do it. You know, even if I had the knowledge of I have now and go back, I couldn't do it." And that's the beauty of youth, isn't it?
Mm.
That, you know, you think you can do it. You know, you just go ahead and do it. You know, and this is what all of us were doing. We didn't think about the bigger problem. We just focused on what we could achieve within that time. And that helped as well, because there were a lot of people that complained and moaned, but they still stuck with the project. Mm. You know, and I think that was wonderful of them to help us out that way, you know.
When you were writing the three stories, you know, I have to think back to a long way now, but what do you remember? Because you're juggling a lot of characters, and obviously you're trying to juggle three stories. What do you remember being like the most challenging storytelling aspects to that part of the process? Because obviously what you talked about so far, I mean, it's all valid, but you know, we're talking a lot about the practicalities of making a film, but for a writer listening to this, what were some of the challenges for you bringing together the story on the page first?
Okay, so basically I did not know how to write a script around about that time. I did and I didn't, if you know what I mean. I'm far more knowledgeable on the three act structure and certain things that happens in scripts now.
Yeah.
So in those days I wasn't. So the way I wrote in those days, which is probably still the same way I write right now, is basically I have an idea in my head. I keep writing. I keep writing. It's like, I don't know if you've ever been to acting class and your teacher pulls out two students and puts them in the middle of the room and say, right, you're the husband, you're the wife. He's had an affair, go. And then they both make it up as they go along.
Right.
Because they've been set a parameter. And then the beauty of writing like that is that these wonderful things start happening. Like with, when I was writing, I wrote the last story first, right? And it was the last story is all about Matthew Palmer and about his girlfriend,
mm-hmm.
who was played by Nicola Stapleton from EastEnders.
Yeah.
And when I was writing it, suddenly Lance had slept with his girlfriend. Lance is his best friend. And I didn't see that coming, you know, that came out of nowhere while I was writing, while I was improvising. So when you're improvising that way, it you have to fight yourself out of a corner because you're being pushed in one way. And then like, I'm going, oh, okay, right. Now, what's Matthew going to do? And so all comes out as you're trying to correct or trying to push this situation around, you know, just by improvising. And so the first story was the last story that I wrote. That was a babe to die for. After I finished writing that one, I thought it worked so well that I'm going to carry on writing the other three like that. The interrogation was a story that I already wrote because that was the first short I shot, mm-hmm. and I reshot it for the movie.
Got you.
So that was kind of already written, but I kind of improved on it. And then the second story was an action tour. It had more action in it than the other two. And I wrote that one as well, the same way I wrote the first story. And then once you had the three stories together, when you look at all three stories together, you can move things around, like, and you can make them all connect. Like, for instance, the woman in Black's gun doesn't work when, let's go back a bit. Okay, so the two guys that, the two people that were interrogated, they meet these two guys in a cafeteria to buy guns off them.
Right.
And one of them says, I sold this gun to this woman and it doesn't work well, but she loves it. She loves the unpredictability of the weapon. So when I wrote that, when I went back to my first story and I thought that'd be really good if he's trying to shoot Lance and the gun's not working, you know? And so I implemented that bit, that what he said, into the story of the last story. And then I had to implement that into the story of the second story, because it was the woman in black who beats up all the men in the second story. That was the gun that they sold to her. And then I got those two fellas that was in the cafeteria meet Matthew at the ending in the last story. And that connects to why, Kerry, who is played by Nicholas Stapleton's character, is with the main character. You understand? So once you've written a story, you can change them to connect to each other, and you move things around.
I certainly do know what you're saying, because you create your own setups and payoffs, and suddenly you're beginning to find answers to questions you didn't even know you were asking yourself. But the answers become solutions to your story. So, like you say, the woman in black and the conversation over the gun becomes a continuity thing, and it becomes a mm-hmm. thing to actually highlight, as opposed to, I guess, in your mind originally, it's just, well, this is some backstory for me to understand about what's going on. And then then it just mushroomed into something much more important.
Also, as when I wrote, you know, when I wrote the interrogation and he meets the Yardies at the ending, I remember everybody was saying to me, I remember when I was writing the Yardies, I got a lot of black friends and they were saying, no, they're not talking, you know, they're not talking like Yardies. And I'm like, well, that is just, you know, that's one of the things.
You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop. and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand, and even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
As I changed, because I my friend Eddie, who played the head yardie, he was talking very plain. And I was saying to him, look, you know, we don't want to go down that road. We want this film to be different. We want the people in the movie to be different to what you see in movies. Like I think I was one of the, because where I live in Battersea, right? I live in a council estate.
Yeah.
So when I was growing up, there were people, white people that spoke like black people around, and I knew a lot of them. And so I had the character called Iron Jaw, and I can't remember. I had those two characters speak like black people. And yeah. I don't know whether I was before the Tarantino movie or after the Tarantino movie, but I never knew that he did that.
You mean the Gary Oldman character in True Romance?
Yeah, exactly.
That was early 90s.
So So maybe he did. Obviously, he did it before me. But I never saw that film until later on in my life. As I said, I grew up with people like that. You know, that would speak that way. You know, they'd even say the N word, and you'd think, well,
you're white.
You know what I mean? So those kind of characters that was in my movie. But most of it, like for instance, getting a gun. They used to have a toilet in Clapham Junction, in the middle of the road, and they shut it down because we heard that they were selling guns in there. So basically, what you do is you go in the loo, and you remember the bowls they used to have. Used to have this big thing, and used to be right at the top. I think it's the SIS system used to be right at the top, and that's where they used to hide. That's where they used to hide the guns. You used to wrap them in plastic and put them in there.
Oh,
so
wow.
When you brought a gun, you'd go to the toilet, go up there, open the system, take out the gun. And there was a lot of that happening around when I was growing up.
Blimey.
And they obviously closed the loo down because that was what happening. And that's where I got the idea for them buying guns and stuff like that. And also another fact that, we're talking about scripts where I was about to bounce. So that's the way I approach writing The Killing Zone. I approached it in such a way that I was improvising along the way with each story. I still do improvise, but now I have a structure of where I'm going, and within the structure I improvise along the way.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean I think that's every, you're almost describing everyone's learning curve, is that there's a certain energy you can bring to writing when you naively don't really know the rules as such that can get you so far. But it's hard to replicate. Whereas adding process to it, like you would add process to it, because obviously you can accidentally get a great shot, but you can never replicate it. So it's always better to know how you got the shot or how you got to how a process got you to a solution in a story, so you can replicate it. And I think that's where we grow.
Writing characters as well. I deliberately wrote almost every character worth playing. Because I remember somebody telling me a long time ago that, you know, I was talking to one actor and he was saying, yeah, I'm in this film. And he's like, yeah, I've only got one part in there, blink and you miss me and stuff like that. And so I was thinking to myself, well, okay, if I have characters in this film, there's going to be a reason why they're there, all of them.
Mm.
And so that's what I set out to do. Every character had a reason to be there, even no matter how long they were within the film.
So let me jump into the production challenges. And there's two things I really want to focus on. And you've already mentioned her once, the woman in black, which is obviously a frenetic sequence and very technical sequence at that. So do you want to talk through how when you're on a micro budget and you're up against the clock, you can choreograph and coordinate a fight scene amongst multiple people.
Well, we did all of that before we set foot on the set. So basically, we did rehearsals with that in another location. So we had a stunt guy named Dave Judge.
Yeah.
He's a brilliant stuntman. In fact, he's one of the people from the production that's really gone far. He's worked on Game of Thrones. He's worked on so many big productions. He was actually in Quantum of Solace. He gets beaten up in the lift by James Bond.
Wow.
So Dave Judge is a really good friend of mine, and he was just starting out. And so him and another guy he was working with at the time, we got all the actors together, and we got Melissa, who plays the woman in black, and we rehearsed that fight. Rehearsed the fight for, I think it was 2 days, to make sure everybody knew what was going on. And because we had access to the building that we were shooting in, we had access to, I think it was the fifth floor, which was the top floor, and the third floor. While we were shooting stuff with Palmer, going down the corridor and shooting people, we had Dave Judge came in, and he took those actors upstairs on the location where they were going to fight and rehearsed again with them, because we were going to do it the next day.
Fantastic.
So, you know, so you got to think about these things, because if you don't, then on the day you'll be trying to figure out what you're doing. Plus we had two cameras on the day. We had two Super 16 cameras on the day to try and shoot that as fast as we can. But also, I don't know if you've noticed that when the fight starts, the camera is at head height. But then as it keeps going, the camera is looking up towards everybody. And the reason being...
Go on, tell us.
...is that... The reason being is that if you look at the set that we're on, or the location that we're on, there are windows left to right, big windows.
Yeah, you're in a big office, aren't you? Big old abandoned office, really, aren't you?
Right, yeah. So there are big windows. But, right, we only had a day to shoot it. So the light will dispense. So that's the reason why towards the end of the fight, the camera's looking up at everybody, because we were trying to avoid the windows.
Oh, wow.
It was dark outside. So, and we had these lights so we can, my DOP lit it in such a way that it looks like the light was coming from, the daylight was coming from the windows. So, you know, we actually thought about these things, how to cheat. I mean, I think my DOP came up with the idea, let's just move the camera down, you know, and avoid the windows and stuff like, because we shot them coming in, because that's a wide shot and you can see all the windows. And when she's leaving, we shot that the same time. And then everything else we shot, we kept shooting until obviously the lights went down.
Did Melissa Simonetti, did she get the role because she was able to handle herself in a fight, or was that something she learned for the role?
Nope. She didn't know any martial arts at all.
Wow, that's, I feel like I've been duped. She was very convincing.
She didn't know any, but she, you know, thing is though, because we had auditions, when I saw Melissa, right, I just thought to myself, that girl looks hard. She looks hard, you know, and she was much more threatening than any other actress that came in to play that part. I don't think she's Italian, but she has that very Italian hard look, you know. And also, as a person, I love Melissa. She's like a really good friend of mine. When she hugs you, she hugs you. She squeezes you, you know.
Okay.
And it's not deliberate either. You know, it's that kind of woman. Do you know what I mean?
You know you've been hugged.
Yeah. She's quite strong. And I saw that in her when she was doing the rehearsals. Sorry, the auditions. And so it was a very easy choice for me. And plus, when we were rehearsing, it was obvious that she took to throwing punches very, very fast. She actually smacked her hand on the floor in rehearsal, and she had to be taken to the hospital point. Yeah. So, but she was okay though. She was fine. So when we were doing rehearsal, she was really giving it a good go, and everybody else.
It comes across as a really genuine fight. So yeah. So hats off to her if she's not got a, if she doesn't already have a background in martial arts to start with.
Yeah.
From a from an aesthetic point of view, I'm one of my big lockdown discoveries. I mean, it's not a discovery for the world, just for me, has been to go back over classic film noir. I think I was always a fan of sort of modern noir, but I went back and retraced the sort of origins of it, sort of Kiss Me Deadly, that kind of thing, and Touch of Evil, and I was really impressed with your sort of your nod to the look and feel of film noir. You know, you use, there's a lot of people who come into rooms and we got that kind of either mid or close up shot of the actor's response. It really doesn't matter what they're looking at in some senses, because that would cost money to produce. And I think that's what a lot of the noir films did back in the day for the same reason, or it wasn't possible to produce it. So everything's reliant on the actor's performance in terms of how horrified they are, how shocked they are, how frightened they are, or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
But also you do the very stylistic decision of sort of aping within colour the, what do you call it, the chiaroscuro of the sort of blacks, you know, the hard blacks and the hard whites. And then we get those lovely scenes where you've got the light coming in through the slatted window and people are stripped with light and stuff. What was your thinking there? Was that literally your, like, I'm doing a homage to, or was it something you discussed with Alan Dunlop as your cinematographer and how it might work for the film?
No, we discussed it. We discussed it. And we were trying to get that tone. I don't think we achieved it personally. We're trying to get, there's an incredible tone in The Ipcress Fire, which, as I said, one of my favorite movies. And the way they lit it was very hard, harsh light. But we also wanted a lot of color in the movie. We also wanted each story to have a different color palette.
Okay.
So the bit in the beginning in the pub, which is a place called Janet's Planet, which doesn't exist anymore. There was a lot of color in that. It was red. There was yellow and stuff like that. So that was very colorful. Then when you get to the interrogation, which is the first story, everything is kind of blue because it was meant to be imitating the dread of the situation.
Okay, that's interesting.
So the dread of these two hapless criminals that were in trouble with the syndicate, more or less. And that was the first day we saw Padraic, who played Matthew Palmer, in his costume. And I almost fell off my chair because it was exactly the way I imagined it.
Oh, wow.
And he turned up in his costume and his coat and stuff like that. Yeah. So the second story, was the one that suffered because we didn't have enough lights to light that properly. So we had to light it the way we could get away with it. So there's a scene in it where in the second story, because there's two stories in the second story. There's one with the politician that Matthew is there to kill.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the second story. Actually, there's three stories. So Matthew's there to kill the politician with the help of another assassin who warns him on the telephone. And the other story is the politician's wife that comes in and finds that he's having an affair. So there were kind of three stories within it, but we didn't have enough light to light it in such a way that it would look good. I mean, out of all three stories, I think that one was the one that suffered the most when it comes to lighting. It didn't look too bad, but it could have been a whole lot better. But
I mean, I guess I'm just coming from a kind of fanboy point of view, is that I admired your kind of nod to the classic noir, you know, because obviously your story is a heightened version of what it's like to live in the shadows of what goes, you know. People in normal walks of life don't cross paths with Matthew Palmer. They don't, you know, even though they might well have had a drink in the jazz bar that he plays in, but they're not going to cross him in a kind of ill way. So once you get into that realm of we're following a guy who's living life the wrong side of the tracks, then everybody who he drags into his life ends up becoming on the wrong side of the tracks, as it were. Or the kind of people you mix with are already there anyway. So I just like that idea, you know, because it's a very stylistic choice. It's not necessarily story critical. It's just of that oeuvre, it made sense to see the little scene shot that way. When you got to the edit, of so when you got this film in the can and you got to the edit, what was, because you know they say you write it, you shoot it, and then you edit it. You know, there's the basically the three big stepping stones of writing in a way. We can talk about how you wrote it, but actually, when you get into the edit, there's a whole other discovery to make, isn't there? So, in terms of what you saw on the page and then what you saw in the can, as it were, what was there any significant changes you had to make in the edit that deviated from what was on the page when you shot it?
None whatsoever. The reason why is because we shot what we needed because of time and money, and also the lack of Super 16 film. We know we knew could only go two takes, three takes. I think the most we went was seven takes at one point.
Right.
So, you know, in those days, you know, you're talking about real film, talking about 16 mil, you're talking about if there's a hair in the gate, you're shooting again. Do you know what I mean?
Of course,
so my camera crew was Cliff Harden, who was on camera, he was a phenomenal cameraman. He knew exactly what he was doing. He knew that, you know, he basically cleaned iris out. Now, every time we took a shot, him and a guy named Wavy, they were brilliant. Wavy was focus pulling, Cliff was on camera, and they knew exactly what they were doing. They knew what lenses they wanted and stuff like that, together with the DLP. So I always say to people, it's the triangle at the top. If you want to make a low budget film, you've got to have the triangle at the top. The triangle is the director, the camera person, and the DLP. If those people are experienced, everyone below that line of various experiences, it can work. And I've done that like three times already, and it's always worked. So I knew what I was doing to a certain degree. Alan definitely knew what he was doing. Cliff definitely knew what he was doing. Me and Julian were learning about how to produce and how to wrangle crew and stuff like that. So it does work. It really does work if you think that way. Plus we were kids, and you know, we were determined.
I mean, and being determined obviously is going to be like you said at the start, is a key factor anyway. Why Super 16? Why not digital video? I mean, obviously we think about
it.
There
wasn't
time.
Digital video at the time.
Was it not already around 1999?
Nope, not at all.
I was thinking 28 Days Later is what, 2002, isn't it?
Yes. So we're talking about I started writing 1997.
Right.
98, okay. We shot the film. 99, it came out.
So Super 6, so in a way, in retrospect, looking back now, as we talk to an audience today, the reason for Super 16 was that would have been what the most cost-effective colour film stock you could have chose to use?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, we couldn't shoot it on 35 because that was just too much.
Yeah.
We got Super 16 film, and it was short ends. Some of it was short ends. Most of it was new. You know, and also you couldn't see the rushes either. So once everything was shot, you know, they'd tape up, you know, they'd get the film out, put it on the spool and run it so it can go to the baths and get cleaned and stuff like that. And we never saw any of the rushes at all until, you know, it came to us, you know, because at that time it'd go through the telecine and it'd get cleaned, you know, and stuff like that. And, you know, I think it was called wet wash or something like that. I can't remember, such a long time ago. But yeah, so we had to believe that everything we shot was shot well.
Interesting.
You know.
Well, let me ask you one last question, Ian. Given this was such an amazing achievement to get this all done with all the people you got, you managed to get to be involved and collaborate with you. Do you want to share with us a kind of one of your fondest memories of shooting The Killing Zone?
One of the fondest memories. The thing is, though, it was a nightmare shooting the movie. It really was. I mean, you know, as I said, you know, me, Gavin, you know, Gavin's my first, and the members of the 712, you know, there were a few arguments here and there, you know, and people were losing faith along the way. But, you know, we stuck with it. But I guess the only good thing I can remember about it Once it was all edited and stuff, like we had a screening at the BFI, and they're projecting it via video, of course.
Mm.
And once the film started, and the response we got from the film was amazing. It was like every problem we went through, everything that we did, all the problems that we had, all the stupid people that tried stopping us from making it.
Yeah.
It was all worth it because the audience response to the film was just amazing. And I don't say that lightly. It was, we were convinced that somebody would pick this film up and, you know, and take it, you know, and put it out on 35 and put it in cinemas because the response was so good. People laughed at every joke. People, gasped at every, especially when Palmer gets shot towards the ending accidentally via Lance and Carrie.
Mm.
You know, they gasped, you know, they laughed and the film worked. And it really worked really well.
Let's remind people then they can watch The Killing Zone on YouTube. And I'll put a link in the show notes for people. Do you want to talk about anything you've got going on at the moment? Is there anything you want to tell us?
I shot a web series, a really successful web series, and it won loads of awards and stuff.
And what's
Rebecca
that called?
Rebecca Gold is called. Yeah. And again, it's about someone who kills people.
I'm spotting a theme.
I'm doing. Yeah, exactly. It's easier to write what you know, I guess. I'm going to be shooting season two next year, hopefully. Without help of anybody, obviously, again.
Is that available for people to get via YouTube?
Yeah, it's the Rebecca Gold channel that Killing Zone's on, so you can watch Rebecca Gold. Rebecca Gold's only 35 minutes long. It's a web series. It's five parts. Most the longest part is 9 minutes.
Okay.
The rest of them are 5-7 minutes, whatever. You can watch it all together as one short film, or you can watch them all together as each episode.
Mm.
And it's a very successful web series. Obviously, millions haven't watched it, but you know the amount of awards that we won through the festivals has told us that people appreciate what we've done. So again, that was shot with hardly very little money, and you know, and nobody got paid, and you know, for the love of it and stuff like that. And it's far more easy to shoot stuff like that on digital rather than film. And so yeah, so the. You know, Rebecca Gold's on there. Also, a film that I was hired to direct, Fallen Angels, which is a cheesy slasher movie that I got hired to direct a long time ago. It stars Michael Ironside and Jeff Fahey, is on that channel as well. So you can watch that if you want to. That was not my film. That I was just a hired gun on that. Me and Julian were just hired to. It was a co-Canadian, co-English movie. But we had a lot of fun. You always learn. It doesn't matter what you do. You always learn when you're making stuff like this. You learn. And that's the whole point is if you don't have any money and you don't think you can do something, you can. Believe me, you can. And the whole point of making something is so that you can learn. And the more you learn, the better you'll get at it.
Well, look, well, thank you very much for sharing your experience and the journey you went on with The Killing Zone. It just gives me to say thank you very much. No worries. Gives you time on the Britflix podcast.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.